We begin with our mind's eye looking up at the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. There, next to the frieze representing the creation of man, that wonderfully muscled hand of God outreaching to the world, is another frieze. The story of the Garden of Eden. An abject Adam, cowering, broken Eve, outside the gates, punished. Somehow the genius of Michelangelo has captured the whole weight of the burden. Cursed shalt the land be for thy sake. Toil shalt thou eat of it. Christianity has always read the third chapter of Genesis as a tragedy. Fall of man has three acts: temptation, inadequacy, and sentence. And it is not only Adam who was sentenced there at the dawn of time, but all of us. In Adam's fall, we sin it all. Because of Adam's inadequacy, we are psychologically inadequate to the challenges of our being and of our day, hobbled ever by original sin, incapable of achieving our own salvation, awaiting the supernatural grace of God, the indwelling presence of the Son of God, to achieve redemption for us. Now move south, across the Mediterranean, and let us handle one of those magnificently illustrated Arabic manuscripts. The text will be unfamiliar to us, but here is an image that we recognize. In that colorful Arabic minuscule, we see Adam and Eve, again outside the gate, broken by their punishment, but above them, surmounting the picture, the serpent turns Satan, Iblis, smirking, triumphant. Islam has always seen the third chapter of Genesis as an elemental picture of man's temptation, of man's conflict with the seducer, the whisperer, the beckoner, the tempter. And the third chapter of Genesis has been read always as the archetype of each life. Each man confronts his own particular devil. And if he fails to be disciplined, to have the strength, Adam's punishment becomes his own. But it is not Adam's guilt, but the Satan's guile, which to Islam is the central element in the Eden episode. And now, let us move east. Let us walk into the National Museum in Damascus. And there in a room we shall see a recreation of the third century synagogue of Dura Europus. The synagogue will be unexpectedly colorful. The ceiling is entirely tiled with brightly colored images. The floor is mosaic. And the walls are entirely covered with a series of beautiful friezes taken from the Bible. Here is David being anointed king. There Elijah confronting the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. But look as we will not find the scene at Eden. Adam and Eve are missing, unexpectedly so. Our ancestors were somewhat uncertain what to make of chapter 3 of Genesis. Indeed, they tended to dwell in the Midrash on the paradox of the story, that Adam's punishment was his blessing. Adam ate of the fruit. He did evil. And yet his eyes were opened, and his mind became clear as to the meaning of good and the meaning of evil. He learned to think. And the banishment from Eden deprives man only of immortality. And really, who of us would wish to live endlessly? And how does one put into color, into harmonious line, the paradox deep within the lineaments of the the biblical story. Now, how is it that the three great faces of the world can take 41 rather simple Hebrew sentences, and that's all that this story requires, and come to such disparate conclusions as to its meaning? The question is logical, but the answer is really almost self-evident. The First Amendment to our Constitution is but one sentence long. But what libraries have been written to prove that there must be a high wall of separation between church and state, or that the government may grant this fund or that fund to parochial education? To insist that man has the right to view or to read any piece of literature, any film that someone desires to present, or to argue that the society has a right to regulate and to censor. And yet, we confront this one sentence of our Constitution in its own language. Its language is ours. And we confront the Bible, most of us, at the once removed, in a translation. The Bible is Hebrew. We read it in English. And every translation is an interpretation. Some elements are emphasized, others are minimized, sometimes unconsciously. Idiom changes. One cannot transpose language to language without distortion, sometimes deliberately, as men, for their own theologic or political reasons, determine to read into a text that which they want to find there. The first translation of the Bible was done by Jews in the second century before the Common Era in Egypt, and the Bible was translated there into Greek. This translation is known as the Septuagint because, according to a legend found in the apocryphal letter of Aristeus, 70 scholars worked independently translating into Greek the biblical manuscript. And at the end of their work, they compared page by page, line by line, each of their 70 texts, and lo and behold, they were identical. Every comma, every period, every adjective, every idiom. This is enough to discredit the story on its own merits. I've yet to meet any 70 scholars who could agree on anything. But we can simply, from our own perspective, reread the Septuagint and find how certain passages were deliberately mistranslated for valid reason, or what was believed to be valid reason. Indeed, our holiday of Shavuot, Confirmation Day, occurs in the calendar when it does occur because of a deliberate mistranslation put into the Bible by these Greek-speaking rabbis and scholars 2,100 years ago. According to the book of Leviticus, Shavuot, then the spring harvest festival, is to occur 7 full weeks after the Sabbath of Passover. One numbers 49 days after the Sabbath of Passover, and the 50th day is to be Shavuot. Now, for reasons which are lost to us in the gray mists of antiquity, the Pharisees insisted that this was not the correct calendar, although it was the observed calendar. And what the book of Leviticus really meant to say was that one is to number 7 weeks after the day of rest, which is Passover, Sabbath being translated generically. In other words, one is to number 7 weeks of 7 days after the first day of Passover, and that is to be Shavuot. Obviously, the holiday of Shavuot then occurs much earlier in the week. And these 70 Hebrew scholars simply wanted to avoid any arguments in the Egyptian community by Jews who might read the Bible and insist that this was not what the Bible had originally intended. In other words, they were insisting on sanctifying a Pharisaic innovation by reading it back into the biblical text. Now, early on in the history of our people, even the Jews of Palestine, the Holy Land, lost the ability to speak Hebrew. They began to speak Aramaic, the lingua franca of the Near East. And many a translation called Targum was made from the Bible into Aramaic. And we are now in Roman times. The quality of Roman culture was Greek. The quantity of Roman science was Greek. The vocabulary of Roman philosophy was Plato and was Aristotle. Plato and Aristotle believed in God. But their God was something wholly other from the universe, a deus absconditus, a God about whom nothing could be attributed because he participated in none of the events, in none of the occasions which are natural and with which we think. God is beyond, wholly other, creator, and that is his only relationship to life. Now the biblical God is other. He has none of our human attributes. He is not material, but spiritual. But the Bible is a book of religion, a book of piety, and often speaks with a poetic tongue, seeking to impress. It uses allegory and metaphor rather than the heavy circumlocutions of philosophy. But the authors of the Targumim were deliberate in their attempts to erase from the Bible any indication that God might walk with men or talk to men. In other words, they erased and made leaden the biblical poetry. As an example, you had read to you this morning the third chapter of Genesis. And you'll recall that when Adam and Eve had eaten of the forbidden fruit, like naughty children, they sought to hide behind a tree in the garden from Daddy, from God, so God's eye might not see them, and they might not be found out. And the voice of God was heard walking abroad in the garden at the cool of the day, and the Lord God called out unto Abraham. So the text. In the Targum we read, and the presence of God, the memra de Eloha, the vitality of God was heard abroad in the garden at the cool of the day, and a voice was heard calling out. The sense is there, but at a once removed. God is in the garden, but not quite. A presence, a sense, something which is human and understandable, rather than something which is divine and poetic. Now, the most famous of all the deliberate mistranslations of our Bible occurred with Christianity. Early on, even in the days in which the Gospels were written, the argument was developed by Christians that the Bible prefigured the coming of Jesus, that the prophets had seen in their vision and received by way of revelation a statement that in so many centuries, the Son of God would come and be among men. The most famous of these mistranslations occurs in the prophecies of Isaiah. Isaiah lived at a time not unlike our own, in which the world was torn apart by two gigantic armed power blocks, and in which the only salvation for the small state caught in the middle was a policy of neutralism, of non-involvement. Isaiah was a very belligerent man when it came to eradicating social injustice. But when it came to international policy, he was convinced that only in pacifism, only in a policy of non-entangling alliances and of disengagement, could Israel, Judea, ride out the troubled storms of the day. And he urged such a policy upon the Judean king and the court. And in one of these sermons, he closes his eyes and he dreams, he looks ahead at the blessings which will be Judea's if they are not restive and restless, and if they can avoid playing the game, the heady game of power politics. The harvest will be full. The sun of peace will shine in all of its warmth on the land. And as signal of God's sure, lasting blessing, A young girl shall conceive and she shall bear a child, and the child shall symbolically be named Emmanuel. God is with us. Now, already in the early days of Christian Latin translations, a slight change had been made. And a virgin shall conceive, and she shall bear a child, and the child shall be called the indwelling God, Emmanuel. And an 8th century BC Hebrew prophet is made to prefigure and predict the coming of a 1st century Christian God. I would not have you believe that accuracy of translation, a concern for an honest recreation of the Hebrew text, is a novelty unique to modern days. It is not, either in the Christian world or in our own. As early as the days of the Talmud, scholars were busy comparing variant texts and arguing which was the one which was to be accepted. In the 6th and 7th centuries of the Common Era, a whole series, complicated series of grammatical and linguistic laws were evolved which were to govern all and any new translation into any language. And these laws, the Masorah, were very often painfully and painstakingly written in a biblical text above and below the column of the Bible itself. Already in the 12th century, Maimonides argues that the Bible must be understood in its historical context. In other words, that it is not the Hebrew of his day, but the Hebrew of 2,000 years before, which must be mined in order to understand biblical idiom. And the great grammarians of the Middle Ages, David Kimchi and Ibn Yana and the like, brought the Arab-born science of comparative linguistics to bear as a tool with which to come to a closer and more accurate translation of the Bible. But in modern times, our tools have been sharpened and they have been refined. And due to many reasons, missionary impetus, a desire of people to understand the book, the willingness of religions to acquaint people with the book, there have been innumerous translations into literally hundreds of languages. All this is by way of telling you that a new English translation of the Bible has been begun by a group of Jewish scholars under the auspices of the Jewish Publication Society, and that the first fruits of their work, a new translation of the first five books of Moses, the first section of our Bible, has been completed. It is now ours. And we have the obligation to read it, to judge it, and to come to grips with it. When any such translation is made, three questions force themselves upon us. Is it accurate? Is it beautiful? Is it necessary? Is this new translation accurate? Does it help us get closer to what the Bible originally really meant? You all know the second commandment of our Ten Commandments. It's a law against the making of icons and of idols and of their worship. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or on the earth below, or in the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers unto the children, upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto the thousandth generation of them that love me and keep my commandments. So the earlier English-Jewish translation, from which we read each worship service here at the temple. What of the new translation? Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. What is a graven image? The word itself has tended to disappear. So we read, you shalt not make unto yourselves a sculptured form. simple, direct. It conjures up the same image in a way which we and our children can easily understand. But there is a troubling word in our older translation. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. Is God a jealous woman, angry if his lover does not pay attention and pay court? Not at all. The word jealous came into biblical translation with that wonderful King James Version of several centuries ago. And idiomatically, then, in the 16th century, jealous meant zealous. A God who is concerned with man. So the new translation, for I, the Lord thy God, am an impassioned God. Jealousy had lost that meaning for us, and the new translators have found a word which implies what was originally intended, what the Hebrew intends. But then we come to a difficulty. For I, the Lord thy God, am an impassioned God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. If a man lives a life which is repulsive to God, if he becomes, the Hebrew is, an enemy of God, he is vicious and violent and cruel, and in every part of his being denies God, somehow the stain of his life touches that of his children to the second and third generation. And if he lives a saintly life, a fine, respectable life, the taint of this accomplishment touches his children and his grandchildren almost endlessly. But listen to the new translation. For I, the Lord thy God, am an impassioned God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that reject me. Here we have a new concept. As if anyone who at any point in his life finds he cannot believe God, believe in God, he rejects God as a postulate of thought, as though somehow he has tainted himself and his children. Now, neither Judaism nor the Bible has ever insisted that man must be always and ever, or can be always and ever, constant in his faith. We are not a dogmatic faith. There is no catechism which we recite weekly or daily in our worship. We grow by doubt. And who of us has not known doubt? And so the new idiom is perhaps more awkward than the old. We have here the eternal problem of any translation. As we make progress, we make mistake. Any human undertaking is frail and it is fallible. The new translation, which has many virtues, is not in itself the answer to all interpretive problems. Is the new translation beautiful? Now we have a way of feeling that the old English translation of the King James, or the Bible with which we read, with which we are familiar, has a beauty, the beauty of age, the sanctity of worship, almost a dignity which comes from not being clear, from not being understood. We sometimes forget that these older translations are often heavy-handed. Language is involuted. The cadence is difficult. The thought is not logically developed. But we like it. We're familiar to it. Religion should somehow have an aura of the mysterious about it. And these older translations had this and had moments of great literary magnificence. The new translation has the virtue of simplicity and the virtue of directness. And has all the plainness of the Midwestern prairie. It is the language of the street, the language of every day, the language of accurate scholarship, the language which all too rarely takes off, soars, and lifts us up with it. Let me read you for a moment a few lines from chapter 3 of Genesis, which were read to you in the older version today. Now the serpent was the shrewdest of all the wild beasts that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, Did God really say, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the other trees of the garden. It is only about fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden that God said, you shall not eat of it or touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to the woman, you're not going to die. God knows that as soon as you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, who knows good and bad. When the woman saw that the tree was good for eating and a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable as a source of wisdom, she ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, and she gave son to her husband also, and he ate. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they perceived that they were naked, and they sewed together fig leaves, and they made themselves loincloths. Short, declarative, clear, a story, a wonderful newspaper report, the Bible. Was this translation necessary? It's a good question. We've had a rash of English translations of the Bible. The National Council of Churches of Christ sponsored a magnificent new translation which was completed about 8 years ago, known as the Revised Standard Version. University of Chicago has a fine, modern translation. So does Dartmouth University. The universities of England are bringing out another. Catholic Church is involved in a third. Now, why do we need a Jewish translation? Have we Jews a copyright of the Bible? Unfortunately, we have not. Our synagogues would be well supported did we have one. Need there be a Jewish translation of the Bible? I spoke to you of deliberate Christian mistranslations. I insist that these occurred 1,500 years ago. The best of critical Christian scholarship has long since recognized Christianity stands on its own feet, that Jesus stands on the quality of his own message, and that they need not fumble back in the Bible, flip its pages to find some prefigurement of Jesus in order to establish his quality. But there are still subtle differences which come because we are intimate with the Bible. It is ours, and we read it in Hebrew. And because other faiths have had it in a series of translations, and have it represent differences in their idiom. Take the sixth commandment. Thou shalt not murder. It's clear. Man is not wantonly or wickedly to take another life. Lo tirsach. Thou shalt not murder is precisely the translation of the Hebrew. But pick up any one of these modern Christian Bibles, and what do we read? Thou shalt not kill. Now, is the sixth commandment a plea for vegetarianism? There has never been an inkling of this in biblical history or in any Jewish tradition. Is it the proof text of the morality that if a man strikes you on the one cheek, you are to turn the other also? Of passive resistance as the only confrontation that a moral man can make to wickedness? Now, that morality is a noble one and can be established philosophically and otherwise. But it is not biblical morality which insists, thou shalt burn out the evil from among you. And if the crazed man, the Hitler, comes at you, you have the right to defend at the cost of his life, if necessary, your life and the lives of your family. Judaism has never had this element of passivity to it. There is nothing in the Bible, in the language, or in the context of biblical literature which permits this translation. And here we are at the fountainhead of all ethics, at the Ten Commandments. And here we have one of those subtle yet very important differences, which leads to differences in politics, in emotional outlook, a different confrontation of the obstacles of life, and the necessity of having a Jewish translation. A Jewish translation is a good thing to have. It's good for Jews. It's good to be reminded that we not only gave a book to the world, but we retained it for ourselves. And we are not only the givers, but the upholders. That Judaism is not to be something to be validated by its glories once upon a time. It is not a label, but our love. That we are not only a cultural community, but hopefully a community of committed people. And to what are we committed? To a book. And to a tradition of which the book is fountain, head, and depth, and direction. And the very work of translation, with all its opportunities and all its obstacles, with its achievement and its failing, is a reminder that we too must review it, reread the text, and reapply the text to our lives. No translation will ever excuse any of us from learning Hebrew. To understand the Bible, to read it, you must read it in Hebrew. We cannot depend upon scholars only to present the Bible to us. But at least we have this, a new translation, a new excuse if we need one, to open the cover, to read the page, and a new pretext if we need one, to involve ourselves in the greatest book known to man, our book, the Bible.